Welcome back to the Black Photojournalism Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitaker. In this episode, we're going to Las Vegas. But not the Las Vegas most people would think of, especially in the 1950s and 60s, when the Rat Pack reigned supreme. Sure, we'll take a detour to the Strip at some point, but we're going to the west side of Las Vegas and into the work of the photographer Clinton Wright, without whom the history of a close-knit and thriving Black community may have been lost. Let's start with a little context and perspective.
My name is Aaron Mays. I'm curator for visual materials at UNLV Special Collections and Archives.
UNLV, or the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, now houses the Clinton Wright Collection of some 8,200 photographs, covering every aspect of Black life on Vegas's west side, mostly dating from 1964 to 1971.
When I pull back and I look at what's in the archive, what we had before we had Clinton Wright, one set is pictures that were donated by a gentleman who was doing code enforcement. This was a person whose job it was to go look and to say, this shack in the back of behind this house is wrong. That doesn't mean that people were living there, and it doesn't mean that everything was bad there, but that's the impression that came across. And so we have lots of pictures of code violations on the West Side, that kind of stuff. And those pictures are used a lot to show the early days of the West Side, and it paints a picture that is incorrect. When you add Clinton's pictures into the work, you get a different picture.
Aaron pulls up a photograph Clinton Wright took in 1964 at a debutante ball for Black young women called Les Femmes Douces. It features prominent community members alongside a debutante named Deborah Roberts and her proud father. Deborah wears a tiara in her updo, a triple string of pearls, a white gown, and matching opera gloves.
We have four men in tuxedos who are just dashing, and this absolutely stunning woman in the middle who's, you know, coming of age. Like, you couldn't paint a better picture of what a cotillion ball should look like. And Clinton did that. He was able to add that context into an archive where the only context came from really a place that wasn't meant to say this is what it is. And you can add too, you know, outside of the context of just our archive, the newspapers are the first run of history. And if that's the only run that you have, if that's the only take that you have, you're going to have an incredibly skewed piece where it's police action and problems, not, you know, kids in marching bands and people, you know, diving off diving boards and the such. It's just not going to be a full, robust view of the history of a space.
Good morning, this is Clinton Wright, and it's good to be able to get on and do this interview.
Clinton is speaking to us from where he now lives, near his children in Plano, Texas.
When I was an early teenager, we had a Kodak box camera, and I didn't have one for myself even then. And my cousins had one, and sometimes I would borrow a camera and take pictures. One of my brothers was also interested in pictures at that time, and he and I would take pictures and sell them and make us a little change. I think they even started around 20 cents a picture, and he sell them to the people. So after that, I got interested and started doing pictures myself. Then I saw things in photography magazine, and I studied that and I gained knowledge how to get what you want and make it like you wanted it. That was in Arkansas. It's a little town, was named Altamaha, Arkansas. It's about 50 miles from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Clinton was born in 1940, so this is all happening in the 1950s.
My oldest brother was the first one to move to Las Vegas, and he got employment there. His salary was much better than it was in Arkansas. He himself was able to make more money for one person working than the whole family in Arkansas was. So he established a residence in Las Vegas, and he sent for the family, and they all moved to Las Vegas while I was in college. And when I graduated from college, I moved there also and got employment and made my home there, got married, and have two children. Las Vegas, I had looked at as a place I never would want to have my children grow up, but after I was there, it turned out different than I had thought at first.
This was largely due to the Black community on the West Side, which, when Clinton arrived in 1959, was entering its heyday.
I am Clay T. White, the director of the Oral History Research Center.
This is also at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, which, as we said, now holds Clinton's negatives. Clay T. works alongside Aaron Mays, who we heard from at the top of the episode.
I collect oral histories throughout the Clark County area, and Clinton Wright is one of the people that we interviewed years and years ago.
Clay T. is also something of an expert on the West Side.
So the West Side community gets started in the late 1920s, 1930s. Prior to that, African Americans lived in the downtown community just like everybody else. The Hoover Dam construction begins to bring lots and lots of immigrants into the area, lots of migrants who need work. It is now the Great Depression. Everybody is coming here. So downtown is getting too crowded for homes and businesses. So white people began to move eastward out of the downtown area. And they tell the Black community that they want them to move across the tracks. And that does begin to happen. It's a gradual process that happens over the years, but Blacks do move into that West Side community. Blacks couldn't get the kind of financing that the white communities were able to get as they moved out of the heart of downtown. But the West Side became the home of African Americans, where they built their businesses, owned nightclubs, restaurants, barbershops, beauty shops, hotels. So the community was vibrant at that time. It wasn't unusual for people to mingle on Jackson Avenue and the surrounding streets where the churches were located. The church was the hub of the community at that time. And of course, the business community, like I said, was a vibrant place with lots of different businesses. We had an early credit union built in the West Side. It was called the West Side Credit Union. We have one of the school teachers, Mabel Hogarth, who worked along with the founders of that credit union to have children opening bank accounts. So the community actually worked together, cultivated this family atmosphere, established a community that was progressive. We had people who were the first doctor, the first dentist, the first attorney. We had all of these people migrating here along with people working in the factories.
Yet we can't forget the surrounding context here.
African Americans up until 1960 could not go on the Las Vegas Strip or downtown to enjoy what was happening in casinos. Could not have dinner, go to shows, gamble. You could not do that. So that entertainment was relegated to Jackson Avenue and the small streets that cross Jackson Avenue. Entertainers like Sammy Davis Jr., Nat King Cole, Pearl Bailey, after their shows on the Las Vegas Strip, they had to go back to the West Side as well. They lived in boarding houses on the West Side. And if they wanted to hold an after-hour jam session, this is where it took place, on Jackson Avenue.
Here's Clinton Wright again.
There was this Black newspaper called the Las Vegas Voice, and that was for the Black people in the community. And they needed a photographer, and I was recommended to him by a friend of mine. And that's the way I started doing the photography for the newspaper. And whenever anybody wanted to have their photos in the Las Vegas Voice, they would ask for me to come and take their pictures. And the newspaper would send me out to do the photography. I was able to get into doing weddings, baby pictures of school projects, fraternities, sororities, celebrities, sports, all of that. So that's the way I built my business. I think what inspired my editor, Dr. West.
This was Dr. Charles I. West, a prominent community member, medical doctor, and civil rights activist.
Was to show the positive things that were going on in the community. There are two newspapers in Las Vegas, but when you ever see articles or news in their papers, it was about crime. of somebody who had been involved in crime and things like that. So this was the only positive thing that we didn't deal with crime.
There's one photograph that Clinton himself loves of a young black boy taking flight off a diving board at the Westside's Doolittle Community Center pool.
I was there to photograph a baptism.
This is also happening in the pool, on the other side, as community members in their Sunday best watch four babies being baptized in the shallow end all at once. Clinton, of course, got great photographs of the actual event, too.
And while I was there, I had my camera and everything ready, and I heard a noise. I heard a plop, big plop in the water, and the guy was hollering, "Yeah, yeah, yo!" And then I looked, and I see he continued to do it. I said, "Oh, let me get my camera. Maybe I can get one now." I was hoping that after I got my camera ready for the next one that I could capture just the moment when it was, you know, dynamic, just to have him just flying in the air.
Other photographs in Clinton's repertoire depict voter registration drives, black educators with their students, Jackson Avenue showgirls, community meetings, fundraisers, local bands and choirs, basketball teams, football teams, baseball teams, scenes inside local businesses like barbershops and record stores, Alpha Kappa Alphas hosting fashion shows and posing with their sweethearts, a childcare center with toddlers working on table manners and art, and Westside professionals posing on site at their jobs.
I think it basically shows that even though there was segregation, that didn't stop people who were interested in doing positive things in the community. They didn't let it hold them back, and the whole history could have been different if it had not been all these people who had a positive interest to do things at that time, and still just sitting down and say, well, you know, what it is, what it is.
Yet changes were afoot in the 1960s on the West Side and beyond. And Clinton's body of work remains notable, not only for what it includes, like evidence of integration with scenes of mixed parties and athletics, but also for what it does not include. Here's Clay T. again.
1959 was the year that our first black attorney came to Las Vegas from New York City. And when he first arrived here, he could not open a bank account because his check was so large. So they called the police because they said no black man should have this kind of money. So that was what was happening in 1959 in Las Vegas. In 1960, we have integration. So in 1960, all of the members of the NAACP, following the president of the NAACP, who was James B. McMillan, the first black dentist here, he gets a letter from the national office, and it is saying to all presidents across the country, we want you to uplevel all activities toward integration. So Dr. McMillan said, okay. So he sent a letter to the mayor of Las Vegas, and he said that if this place isn't integrated on this date, the African-American community is going to march down the Las Vegas Strip on a Saturday night. So, of course, they couldn't have that. So negotiations started with the owners of the casinos, the black community, the governor of the state, the mayor of the city. Everybody is a part of this because they actually believed that the black community was going to march on the Las Vegas Strip and that it was going to be televised, and they didn't want that. So over this two-week period, as negotiations go back and forth, the town is integrated, March 26, 1960. So that is what Clinton Wright begins to see in this city at the time. So the beginnings of a new era here. But unemployment in the black community was very high at the time. Black people were very, very unhappy. And by 1969, the promises made to the black community at that point for equal jobs and all kinds of other things, the city had not followed through on making sure that those came true. So by 1969, the community was tired. When integration takes place in 1960, the community thought that some of those jobs in the front of the house, like bartenders, dealers, cocktail waitresses, they thought those jobs were going to be available to the Black community. It did not happen. Blacks were still relegated to jobs in the back of the house, maids, linen room workers, porters. And I'm not talking about the porters that get the tips for carrying the luggage. I mean the porters that clean the ashtrays and the floors in the casinos and hotels. So by 1969, one Sunday afternoon in October, there was some police activity in the Black community, and it was not accepted very well.
Unsurprisingly, police brutality had continued to plague the community post-integration, too.
And that's how the riot started. But it was more like a rebellion that started, rebelling against what was going on. It lasted for 2 to 3 days, and the Black community was shut off from the rest of the city. Because of the limited access going into the West Side community, it was very, very easy to block off some of the major streets, and you then could easily have Black people cordoned off and just being able to stay in the Black community.
Here's UNLV's Aaron Mays again.
As the unrest started and the community became more and more encircled, the National Guard was called out. It became obvious, and there's several people in different oral histories that talk about this was the first time they realized that their neighborhood was really an easy prison. It didn't take much to close down the West Side, and Clinton was at home feeling the same as everybody else. Why is this happening? What's going on?
It was a place that they turned the fire trucks around. The riot did. The fire trucks didn't cross their line. And I got a call from the newspaper across town.
This is the Las Vegas Review-Journal, the major white newspaper in the city.
To ask me if I would go take pictures for them. And I refused it.
You know, to get a call from people who wouldn't give you the time of day any other day of the week, it gives you the impression and the feeling that you really don't matter, that the only thing that they're after is what they can't get. And when you're not wealthy, when you're paycheck to paycheck, you know, that money does sit out there and you do have to think about it. But it was clear that his resolve to not do that was very much a part of who he is.
So this is a photograph of the welfare rights movement.
It was taken in 1971 and depicts a crowd of mostly Black activists on the Las Vegas Strip beneath signs that read, "Don't gamble with human lives," and "Give our checks back." Activists Ralph Abernathy and Ruby Duncan are centered in the frame, with Jane Fonda behind them.
There was a national movement starting in the late 60s, going through the 70s, early 70s. The welfare rights movement did all kinds of things for poor women, not just Black poor women, but poor women who were Latin American and white and Asian, who did not have benefits to feed their families. And in most cases, the face of the movement were Black women across the country. And this is a march on the Las Vegas Strip. On a Saturday, they actually go into Caesar's Palace and they stop the gaming activity for about an hour. And Abernathy actually prays in the casino. But it made headlines because it's Las Vegas. So they got the kind of coverage here that they wouldn't get anyplace else in the country. So that's why Las Vegas was so important to this national movement.
This moment in time is a really good storyteller for Clinton. And I'm going to introduce another person into this whose name is Hank Del Espinoza. And Hank was a wonderful photographer who we recently got his collection too. But Hank was a white photographer and Hank had lots of ability to sell his images. This particular day he was working for a national publication for sure. I'm not sure if it was Time or Newsweek at the time, but there's notes on his stuff that says that his film has to get on the plane, which is how you would get it to New York overnight so that it could make the editions the next day. And Clinton, of course, went back to his small little bathroom, dark room, and did his own work. So they're coming at this very, very differently. And the reason that I say that is that Clinton is part of a press pool here that was invited out. Please come, take pictures. Everybody's welcome, right? at least from the organizer standpoint. But when you get to the property and when you see the pictures that Clinton has taken on the grounds at Caesars, he's playing it safe. He's holding back a little bit further. He's not right up there next to the door. He's getting what he needs. He's not shying away, but he's also not putting himself in jeopardy here. And when the marchers got through the front door and started marching through the casino, he didn't follow them. He said, you know, I'm good. I'm going to stay out here because if they're going to arrest anybody, it's going to be that black photographer and I'm not going to be him. I don't want to get arrested, he said. Hank plopped right through the casino, had no worry at all. They going to arrest the white photographer? No, no. So Hank's pictures kind of follow the crew as they go all the way through the casino. There's a couple little rallying points and has some really interesting pictures of the marchers walking right past tourists with drinks in their hands at the poolside, going, well, what's this ruckus? And then comes out the front. And all that time, Clinton was out front taking pictures of what's going on, basically from the safe street side, if you will. And that just kind of shows the difference that black photographers face in white areas. In this particular image, he's on a truck flatbed that the organizers had planned on. And so he's getting this view. And there are other times where he comes down off and he's mingling in with people right next to where they're walking. And Hank does the same thing. He hops on the truck and hops off as well. So, you know, they're working this parallel line, but not from the same vantage point. And it's really interesting to just line these up side by side and see the way Hank portrayed things and the way Clinton saw them. They're very similar, but there's some subtleties, and it's interesting.
In 1971, we see a consent decree. The consent decree of 1971, filed by that first black attorney, Charles Keller, demands jobs in the front of the house for the black community. And the community was ready at that point to step into those roles and start working in some of those jobs. There was already a dealer school, so African Americans began to become dealers on the Las Vegas Strip, cocktail waitresses, and other jobs that paid the kind of wages that we even hear people brag about today.
It was a time when black people were not held in this little area, and they moved out to wherever they wanted to, and it sort of went into a kind of condition where it's less unity, less concern about showing things that happen in the community. Then it just seemed like the interest sort of faded of doing community activities that involved black people.
In the later 1970s, we began to see the community change. People are moving out, drugs are coming in, and the drugs become an unstabilizing force. One woman tells about owning a nightclub called Love's Cocktail Lounge. It was one of the really popular ones of the era. And she talks about her husband no longer being able to control the elements in the community. So in the 1980s, they have to close their business. And that's just one example, but we understand why that began to happen. Crack cocaine was a force that no one could contend with. That, along with now full integration, people can live in the place they want to live, they have better jobs, and now crack cocaine is tearing the community apart. So we began to see people move out of the black community. Now, there are sections of the black community that never change. I can show you housing areas that were there from the 50s and remain there today. But that business corridor where people came together on Saturday nights and the weekends, those areas changed so completely that now we have all vacant lots. And that is what you will see today if I would drive you down Jackson Avenue right now.
Clinton Wright left the neighborhood too, moving his family to the suburbs.
I was fortunate to move into places where I thought it was best for my children. And they were able to go to very good schools and they had inspiration to do things that were good on a high level. And they came out to be very fine students. I opened a photographer's studio. It was on Las Vegas Boulevard. They call it the Strip. In those years, photography and studio was kind of waning, and the income that you could make from a studio was not very much. Also, I did not work for a newspaper anymore, so just was not an opportunity for much of the things that we did back in the day. Just wasn't there. So, you know, my work in photography kind of faded, and that's what happened in the later years.
Clinton took other jobs in the city to support his family and largely put his photography career behind him. But fortunately, Clinton had held on to his work.
We started an oral history project devoted to the Black community, and one of the people interviewed was Clinton Wright. There was a young woman in the Oral History Research Center who took it upon herself to try to get his collection. So for months, every week, she had it on her calendar, she would call Clinton Wright. Finally, he said yes, and several of us then got involved, and we were able to get that collection for Special Collections.
It definitely took some convincing. Clay T. doesn't remember exactly what sealed the deal.
But let me guess. We probably told him that we didn't have any evidence of what it was like in the Black community in this city. That we had photographs of Black people being thrown against the wall and being handcuffed. And we needed people to see the other side of Black life in Las Vegas. This place was nicknamed years and years ago the Mississippi of the West. Because of that, we needed to be able to show another side of the picture. We needed to show people that Black life here is just like Black life every place else in the country. And these photographs did that for us.
For Aaron Mays, the Clinton Wright collection has been personally illuminating as someone who grew up with very different ideas about the West Side.
You know, my background is that I grew up in Las Vegas, and I grew up in a very white side of Las Vegas. And my family and people around me and the people that I knew never had been there and never talked nice about it. It was always a bad place. You didn't want to go. And looking at Clinton's pictures was like getting slapped in the face, because it was like, this isn't what I was told. This isn't what I thought. And I think that that's the beauty and the power in his work. And I can say that I have made it very much a mainstay of my work to make sure that his donation is understood and brought forth in a way to honor him and to honor his work and to honor the community that was there and is there, because all of them deserve that. None of them deserve what I was told as a kid. So because my work is quite varied, I'll get a lot of requests and people asking about Las Vegas history. And it's always fun for me to kind of interject a couple images in. And almost invariably, they're like, well, that's not Las Vegas. That's not what happened in Las Vegas. And I get to say, oh, well, actually it is. Let me show you how. Let me show you where. And it's kind of nice to be able to do that and to have these kinds of tools to help people understand our history.
Yeah, I realize it's very good because of what it shows. If this hadn't been done, there would be no way that anyone could go back and tell what happened to the depth and the extent that you can find in these photographs and the life that people lived in a segregated time and what happened and how it was dealt with and progress and everything. Shows the history that nobody could ever tell if they tried to without pictures.
My name is Elena, and I am Clinton Wright's oldest daughter. And the thing that I want people to take away is that I'm proud of my dad. And the memories that I have of my dad developing his photos in the makeshift lab that he created in the attic of our house, I remember him going up there. I remember the smell, and I remember him developing the pictures. I also remember him using myself and my brother as models for the photography. I also have a picture that I hold with fondness of being held as a baby by Ralph Abernathy. And I didn't learn until I entered school and used that photo as a project, how monumental that was to be held by such a famous civil rights activist as a baby. Being able to see my dad's collection in this new light, it definitely just gives me a greater perspective and just makes me feel so proud and just have a greater awareness of the impact of what my dad was doing.
My name is Kurtrin Wright. I am Clinton Wright's son. And like my sister, I'm very, very proud of my dad and his work. A lot of these images, they predated us. And so when we were growing up in the, you know, 80s and 90s, we did not have these images. We did not know of a Black community that was so regal and so elegant and so proud and so excellent. We grew up and we saw pretty much the burned down and the dilapidated. And so to know what really happened was only really captured in his pictures. That brings a lot of value to the work that he's done and shows that what he gave to UNLV is something that the whole community and the world really can benefit from.
Clay T., Aaron, and their team at UNLV have been working diligently to digitize Clinton's work and add metadata so people, places, and events can be more easily found. They also print the work, show the work, and share it with other institutions like Carnegie Museum of Art, and with filmmakers and other creatives looking to tell stories about Vegas and the West Side. But in addition to this essential recognition of a past, Clinton's work is also helping rebuild a community for the future. Here's Clay T. again.
I'm just so enamored with the collection. I'm so energized by the collection. And I want you to know that 3 months ago, I moved into the community. I now live in the West Side community. And I am as happy as a lark, but the possibilities are limitless for the plans that are happening now and for what is going to happen on Jackson Avenue. We already have a new library in the area that is just stunning. We have a location of our community college, the College of Southern Nevada, now has a small campus there. We have technology centers that are teaching kids all kinds of STEM-related jobs. So the community is beginning to change in a really, really wonderful way and in a way that is going to make it more robust, more progressive than it has ever been. There is a person who's talking about rebuilding the Moulin Rouge, that first casino that was integrated in 1955, before you could imagine integration taking place. And we already have a Black architect working on the idea. And he is using photographs to rebuild the Moulin Rouge in a way that gives a nod to what happened in 1955. So this collection is a major force for the revitalization of the entire community.
You can see images related to the Moulin Rouge in the Black Photojournalism exhibition at Carnegie Museum of Art. A big thank you to UNLV's Clay T. White and Aaron Mays, and of course, to Clinton Wright and his family. This podcast is a production of Carnegie Museum of Art, Pittsburgh. For more information on this podcast and the Black Photojournalism exhibition, please visit carnegieart.org. We'll see you next time in California.